Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. The Seven Years' War that pitted Britain and France was fought on five continents and touched all corners of the globe. And though it was a truly global conflict, the North American portion of the fighting, the French and Indian War, is considered by many to be the war that made America. Even after 250 years, it remains one of the most important and yet misunderstood episodes in world history. In part one of this three-part episode series, we'll discuss the British offensive of 1755 in the French and Indian War, and the crushing defeats that resulted. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In season one of the series, we're discussing the colonial frontier of North America, the people and ideas that shaped it, and the places and events that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we begin the first in a three-part series to discuss what many have called the Great War for Empire, and what Winston Churchill himself referred to as the first truly world war. That, of course, is the Seven Years' War, known more locally in North America as the French and Indian War. Now, this is an amazing conflict for a lot of reasons, and it's a very important one. And it's for that reason that we're going to take three entire episodes to break it down and really explore it in great detail. One of the amazing things about the Seven Years' War is truly how global the conflict is. It certainly begins from the actions of, some say, one man in North America being George Washington, but it's really truly much more indicative of a much larger conflict and a much larger group of societal pressures at the time that really define the middle portion of the 18th century. It will pit the world's two largest empires and Europe's two primary superpowers, Great Britain and France, in a titanic death match to settle the fate of empire not only in North America, but in the world. It's the great conflagration, as they say, that sets the world on fire. Now, this war takes on many different faces in many different places, and it's why we're taking the amount of time we are to make sure we explore all of them. It's a war that takes place in North America. It's a war that takes place in the Caribbean. It's a war that takes place in Europe, a war that takes place in Africa, a war that takes place in India, and a war that takes place in East Asia. Truly, anywhere and everywhere that these two old enemies, Britain and France, have colonies, this war will set ablaze. It's really an amazing opportunity to study empires in action, and how seemingly unrelated facets and features of one conflict can trickle down and change the lives of everyone involved. The focus we'll take, particularly in wartime, will be the study of North America, and how it changed and shaped the American identity, so much so that historian Fred Anderson famously said this was truly the war that made America. Now, the origins of this war are strange, because it brings into play a lot of dynamics that challenge our conventional thinking about a number of topics. One of them is the early story, beginning with a young Virginian, relatively unknown to history, named George Washington. We studied the events of 1753 and 1754 in previous episodes of Wartime, and I encourage you to look them up, but we'll very quickly review them now in the context of the beginning of the Seven Years' War. For most of colonial history, New France and the colonies of Great Britain in North America rarely came to pass. New France was based in Canada, particularly around the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River Valley, and the American colonies of Great Britain were focused to the east of the Appalachian Mountains. Now, over time, both will begin to expand, and the region in which they first proverbially bump into each other, causing conflict and tension, is a huge swath of territory that today is known as Western Pennsylvania and East Ohio. At the time, however, was known as the Ohio Country. Both have what they believe to be legitimate claims to the region, and the other believes those claims to be illegitimate in every way possible. In reality, they're both reasonably shaky in their own way. The French, however, will be the first of the two superpowers to take the initiative, and they'll begin to build fortifications in the Ohio Country in the form of four forts. They are Fort Lebeuf, Fort Presque Isle, Fort Machault, and ultimately, Fort Duquesne. Now, this begins in the spring of 1753 and continue largely into the spring and summer of 1754. And in the process, we see the colony of Virginia take the lead for the British world and pursue a number of, perhaps, questionable ventures to assert their own authority over the region. A young man, 21 and 22 years old at the time, named George Washington, will in many ways be the center of this story. Again, episode 1 and episode 2 of season 1 of Wartime explore both of these years in great detail. But where we're going to pick up today is going to be the year that many believe that the formative tally and the formative strategy of the early part of what will become known as the Seven Years' War around the world begins to form in North America. It's going to be the year 1755, and it's a story that's going to take us all across the North American continent to all the major regions of the time. In 1755, we're going to see a meeting in a place called Alexandria, Virginia, that will bring together some of the richest and most powerful men in North America. The Council or Congress of Alexandria will be called in 1755 by a man named Major General Edward Braddock. And Edward Braddock is a name that you're going to want to be very familiar with, because aside from being a gifted politician and an experienced soldier, he is a major general in the British military. He is the commander-in-chief of the entire British Army of North America. He is literally the highest-ranking military official on the continent. And because a war with France seems to be looming, Braddock will be the one who begins to formulate, at least in some conception, the notion of a large military venture, what he perceives to be unnecessary and aggressive actions by his eternal enemy, the Empire of France. He'll call to Alexandria that day some of the major political power players of the entire continent, men like the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia itself, Robert Dinwiddie, men like Horatio Sharp of Maryland, Robert Hunter Morris of Pennsylvania, and William Shirley of Massachusetts, along with James DeLancey of New York. This meeting will be held on April 15th of 1775 in the home of Carlyle, one of the wealthiest men in the city. And it is a meeting of the minds politically and militarily rarely seen in the colonial world. Now, there's any number of reasons Braddock would have called this meeting together. Yes, to talk about strategy. Yes, to talk about outcomes of the war. But ultimately, this meeting is called together for one reason and one reason only, and it's to raise money, to raise funds to execute whatever war plan Braddock will come up with. Now, that seems counterintuitive to us. That seems unusual, because it seems like if the British Empire has so much to gain by such a venture, they'd be willing to pay for it themselves. But at this time, that form of overarching government, as much as we mythologize the rule and style of the British Empire, doesn't really exist. If this is going to happen, Braddock will have to raise the money in many ways for the defense of North America himself. Again, he's the highest ranking military official on the continent. That would be pretty standard for the day. Now, some of these governors are receptive to this maneuver, but not all of them. And very quickly they align themselves under the opinion that why should they, as the respective executives of their states, have to pony up most of the money for the defense of the continent? They are British citizens, after all. Shouldn't the British Empire take some vested interest in its defense? Now, this is a challenging understanding for us because we have to understand to really get this, just how powerful the American colonies of Great Britain really were. At best estimates, the American colonists produced what amounts to about 50% of the entire wealth of the British Empire at the time. In their opinion, that makes them very key and critical assets to the larger imperial economy, and they're right. Britain is not just the United Kingdom, the islands we know today, but it's an entire way of life around the world. And it's a way of life they do want to defend against their eternal French enemy. But when it comes to opening, perhaps, the purse strings, they're a little less patriotic than those in London would have liked to hope. But the money will be raised very quickly, and the debate will begin as to how to handle these French invaders, if you would. Again, from the French perspective, the land is theirs anyway. But North America, they believe, will be decided in this form during this time. The fate, the outcome of North America is at stake in the event we call the French and Indian War. Now, keep in mind, there is no war yet. But the gears of war are in motion in both Canada, where the French call their home, as well as in North America. And the plan that they come up with at the Alexandria Conference effectively looks like this. There will be a four-pronged attack at capturing what the members of the Alexandria Conference believe to be the most critical points of the French Empire in North America. All of these points sit on waterways, and if you listen to episode 4 of Wartime, we talked a great deal about how important waterways are to the health and success of the French Empire in North America. It's their great circulatory system that connects everything back to their administrative heart in the St. Lawrence River Valley. These key forts, if they fall, the Alexandria Conference believes, will cause the entire French Empire in North America to crumble. And they are key targets. One target will be Fort Niagara on the Niagara River, where that river meets Lake Ontario. Another target will be Fort St. Frederick, today what is Crown Point, New York. A third target will be Fort Beauséjour on the frontier between Nova Scotia and the land called Acadia. And the fourth target will be Fort Duquesne at the mouth of the Ohio River, which is formed by the southward flowing Allegheny River and northward flowing Monongahela River. Edward Braddock will attack Fort Duquesne himself. Now, in this early plan, it's important we remember there is no war yet, but these are very real marches to war. These are very real movements of war. And these movements will ultimately lead to an ignition of hostilities around the planet, anywhere that the French fleur-de-lis and the British Union Jack fly. It is truly the first great world war in the history of the planet, and the largest war the world will have ever seen at the time. Now, when we begin to study these four movements, that's what we'll do for the rest of today's episode. We're going to break them down one at a time. We're going to spend the first part of the lecture, and the most, because many believe this is the most important venture in 1755, on Edward Braddock's assault on Fort Duquesne. Now, what is it about this feature of the campaigns of 1755 that makes it so important? Well, as far as the French are concerned, Fort Duquesne serves a very real purpose, and we've touched on it briefly already. It's that it fortifies the places where two critical waterways, in this case, three critical waterways, come together. That's how they build their empire in North America, along the lakes, along the rivers, and along the creeks. They don't build cities. They don't build towns, they don't fortify the way the English do, but they build very big and hopefully very permanent blockhouses and forts where major waterways come together. Every single one of the forts we've mentioned already, Fort St. Frederick, Fort Beauséjour, and Fort Niagara, protects a waterway just like that. But there's something very unique about Fort Duquesne in 1755 we have to understand. Fort Duquesne is essentially hooked up with Montreal this way. If you follow the St. Lawrence River, it goes to Lake Ontario. That will go to the Niagara River, which is protected by Fort Niagara. That will allow you to go to the Lake Erie, which will hook up with Fort Presque Isle. Beneath Fort Presque Isle in western Pennsylvania today is Fort Lebeuf on the French Creek. The French Creek will connect with the Allegheny River, protected by Fort Michaux, and all the way south on the Allegheny River, it will collide head-on with the Monongahela River, creating the mighty Ohio River. And there is Fort Duquesne. So what you're seeing is the Ohio River being the vital key here, because the Ohio River is the natural superhighway that connects the northeastern portion of North America with the West, because the Ohio River only goes one place. The Ohio River does have tributaries and streams that branch off of it north and south, but if you stay on that mighty river, it takes you only to the Mississippi, and the Mississippi takes you all the way to New Orleans, the other part of the French Empire, and it effectively connects an empire that spans the distance of roughly Paris to Moscow. So Fort Duquesne, in many ways, is not designed any differently than any other fort. It's a relatively weak fort that's a vital connection in a larger empire. But it's that Ohio River for the French that is their key to not only keeping what they have, but expanding even farther west. So Edward Braddock understands the importance of that place. He wants to be the one that supervises the attack himself. So how does it begin? Well, our story for Edward Braddock begins in May of 1755 in what is at the time Fort Cumberland, Maryland. It's here he'll gather his troops, he'll gather his supplies, and he'll march his men into the great wild unknown that is the Ohio country. With him, he has about 2,000 men. He has about 10 cannons, and they are fully convinced that they can march from Maryland, originally out of Virginia, for a distance of over 100 miles to get to the placement of Fort Duquesne. That placement, today, is the modern city of Pittsburgh. Now, this is not an easy journey. It's not an easy expedition, because all of it, for the most part, aside from using whatever Indian trails exist, will be marching slowly but surely through a very dense and very thick and very inhospitable wilderness of what is today western Pennsylvania. Now, moving these men will be terrible. And the way that he goes about it is this. He begins to build on the process, a military road. Now, this is not a road as we would think of it today, but it is a wide enough path that his men could march effectively through the wilderness. But 2,000 men, really 2,100, is a very difficult group to move. And this path is certainly not wide enough to accommodate all of them. So they were stretched out in a line that extended well over 2 miles long of people. They moved very slowly. It was a very measured pace. But the hope for Braddock was that if he carved his way through the wilderness to Fort Duquesne, he could receive reinforcements. He would move slower, but it would be a much more efficient and effective way for any future endeavors to move into the Ohio country. Not only did Edward Braddock have soldiers on this expedition, and this is a bit revealing for every major army that moved of the four we'll deal with in 1755, so we'll cover it now, but he also moved with those who supply the army, people that cook for them, people that prepare any number of worldly deeds for them. You have merchants, you have traders following every major army. One of these men, interestingly enough, is Benjamin Franklin, who would help prepare supplies for the expedition. Among them were also people like Daniel Boone. You may recognize that name. Also, Thomas Gage, a man who will become a major player in the American Revolution in 20 years from 1755. But they're all part of this massive venture leading out of Fort Cumberland. And it's a very impressive one. The British feel very confident, including Edward Braddock, about it. Now, while they're on the way, Edward Braddock is meeting with a number of Indian chiefs as they move through the effectively Indian territory. And they'll all try to persuade him to use the natives to help them fight. Because if they do, they hope that some of these natives, the respective Ohioans that we've described in previous episodes of Wartime, in this regard the Delaware chief Shingas, that they would gain some land for their assistance. Now here's the issue. Edward Braddock says very famously to the Delaware chief Shingas, "No savage should inherit the land." So what that tells us is that A, Edward Braddock is very confident in his own abilities and the abilities of his force to disregard such a vital assistance as an Indian ally. But B, also, whatever the future of North America looks like, for Edward Braddock, it's very clearly a British future. and the Indian plays very little role in it. Now, because they're making such slow progress to Fort Duquesne, and because of many of the support animals, in a lot of ways, draft animals, are having such a difficult time of it, Braddock made what would become, obviously not at the time, but in hindsight, the benefit of the historian, a fateful decision. He created what we call a flying column, in which he broke off 1,300 of his most vital men to move ahead as an advance force, leaving the additional 800 under the command of a man named Thomas Dunbar behind. Again, these are mostly support staff for the larger army at hand. He would split these men into this flying column to advance their pace. Because some days were so slow, Braddock was only marching something like 2, 3, or 4 miles a day as he advanced toward Fort Duquesne. Now, did the French in Fort Duquesne know he was coming? Well, the answer very likely is yes. All along the way, there were small outbursts of violence and attacks by French allied Indians, and Braddock knew that if they were harassing his line on the process, they were also very likely keeping the French abreast of his movements back north. Now, the issue we have here is we don't know exactly how well prepared the French really were for this. We don't know that they were tracing Braddock's movements day to day, but we do know that they discover his approach within days of the initial attack that we see. So what's the situation like at Fort Duquesne? Well, it's not what we often think of as a fort in the traditional sense. Fort Duquesne is very weak. It has walls that are less than 12 feet tall, made of tree trunks stacked side by side. There are less than 240 Frenchmen actually in the fort. And in truth, the overwhelming majority of them were French Canadians. They were provincials, the equivalent of Americans in the British eyes. They were Canadians in the French eyes. But the real asset and the real threat of Fort Duquesne, at least in the defense, came in the people that surrounded the fort. Because yes, there were only about 240 French Canadians, but there were almost 700 native allies with them. And this is where things get very tricky for us, because these native allies are not regional Indian peoples. They're not the Ohioans of the Ohio country. They're not Shawnee. They're not Delaware. They're not Mingo. They will be. They're there. But the Indian peoples that are fully engaged in this battle are, to those Ohioans, distant foreigners. They're the people of the Great Lakes. Because the people of the Great Lakes, what the French called the Pays d'Anneau, were longtime allies of the French, and they understood what a French victory meant to them. So the majority of these native peoples were Great Lakes peoples. The Ohioans were there. They were anxious to see the outcome of this battle. Many of them even participated. But the majority of the native peoples who will fight in the battle that comes and the defense of Fort Duquesne will not be local peoples. They're the people of the Great Lakes. And that's a very important point to make, because you can miss it when you use a general term like Indians. But here's what we'll see on July 8th. By the time we get to July 8th, Braddock is quickly approaching Fort Duquesne, and he's got an interesting little force with him. One of the people that has turned out to be very close to Braddock during this march was not a native Briton, the way that we think of Braddock, but he was a Virginian, and you could imagine who he was. It was now a 24-year-old George Washington, a full colonel in the Virginia militia. If you listen to episode 1 of Wartime, we talked about the fact that Washington as a character was flawed. He didn't have a father figure that he was close to. His brother Lawrence was the closest he had, and his brother Lawrence died in 1752. Well, Washington was naturally attracted to Braddock for any number of reasons. One, he's extraordinarily wealthy. Two, he's extraordinarily powerful. And three, he is a man in the service of the British Empire. And that is everything Washington wanted to be. It was like a veritable checklist of what he wanted his future to look like. So George Washington at 24 years old was really drawn to Edward Braddock. And Braddock, to a degree, took Washington under his wing for this march. He taught him the ways of the British military. He taught him how to lead men. George Washington is with Edward Braddock at this engagement. Now, about 9 miles south of Fort Duquesne, Edward Braddock and his flying column are marching in formation, discipline wins the day, toward their target. And he reaches the Monongahela River. Now, in truth, he was following the Monongahela River all the way north after a certain point. But to really attack Fort Duquesne effectively, he had to cross it. Because otherwise, if he continued on his course, he would be on the other side of the river, opposite of Fort Duquesne, and that wouldn't be good for anyone. So he begins to cross, and while he begins to cross on July 9, 1755, we see the Indian warriors and the Canadians of Fort Duquesne begin to stir, because they know their enemy is coming. Now, the issue we have is, and this is why we question the intelligence that the French had at Fort Duquesne, was really how well they knew exactly where Braddock was. They certainly knew he was coming, but not how close. Because what we see is, by the morning of July 9th, a chaotic panic at Fort Duquesne. The Indian warriors of the Great Lakes and the Indian warriors of the Ohio country and the 240 or so Canadians begin to charge Edward Braddock's position. Their plan, in totality, was to ambush Braddock as he crossed the river. Because if you're Braddock, you have a fraction of your army on the right bank, and you have a remainder of your army on the left. Your army's divided, and there's that very vulnerable group still in the water at the time. But the issue was, the French, the Canadians, and the Indians were delayed. And as they rushed Edward Braddock, they did so on a very small trail. The other end of that trail, incidentally, Braddock himself was starting to cross onto from across the other side of the river. As they came together, some would say for most of history is an ambush, but we know now, most likely, both armies just collided into one another. It was a complete and total mess. The French tried to rally into formation, the British completely shocked. Braddock at the helm, Braddock at the front, was caught entirely off guard. And they also began to try and rally into position. Everybody began lining up on this tiny trail to volley fire at one another. Everyone except the almost 700 Indians who were involved. And it's the first time that certainly Edward Braddock, but also that the larger British world would ever experience the true terror and just the true disadvantage Europeans faced during an Indian war. The Indians broke rank, and they filed to the left and to the right of the road, using the forest as cover. So while Braddock, the British, and the Americans all attempted to remain in formation, fighting their 240 French-Canadian enemies, the Indian peoples poured on fire from their left and right flanks. It was a total disaster. Edward Braddock himself is shot. He won't die immediately, but it is that shot that will take his life. It's what we would call a meeting engagement more than an ambush. But at any rate, the battle known as the Battle of the Monongahela, or more popularly as Braddock's Defeat, is turning out to be a complete and total disaster. George Washington is involved in this battle. He's with Braddock all the way. And the story and the legend we get from it is almost unthinkable. George Washington is 6'3". He's a very tall man, and he's on horseback. So he is an easy target for the Indian peoples. The story goes that he has two horses shot out from underneath him. He has a series of bullets go through his coat, a bullet perhaps even going through his hat. And all the while, George Washington survives. It's a nice story. In the larger span of Washington's life, it's a neat memento, but in reality, it's things that happen to all kinds of people in almost every battle in the history of mankind. Somebody has to survive. There are a lot of close calls in war. This had nothing to do with the divine providence of George Washington, but what a great story. Edward Braddock will die as a result of this battle, and the British are sorely handed what amounts to the single greatest defeat of the modern British world in modern history. Their great hero, Edward Braddock, falls. They'll have more than 500 British soldiers killed and nearly as many wounded. The French, for their victory, will roughly see 30 killed and 60 wounded. But here's the issue. This is not, as we often say, a French victory. Again, look at the demographics. You've got less than 250 actual French Canadians, but you have nearly 700 Indians from all different parts of the North American frontier. So if you want the narrative to be, at least in regards to the war on the frontier, the story of Britain versus France, almost like a game of chess, the Ohio country being the chessboard. You can use that, but you'll never fully understand it. This was a major Indian victory. But this will make them solid French allies in the process, and hand Britain the worst defeat they'll experience thus far in the entire history of North America. While Braddock's defeat set a very new tone for simply how bad things could be in the potential conflict brewing, remember the Alexandria Conference created a four-part attempt at conquering New France, or at least weakening their infrastructure, to the point that a later British maneuver could be effective. Well, those other three parts were not equally ineffective, but did not give a lot of great reason for hope. If you'll recall, the second part, aside from capturing Fort Duquesne, was an attack on Fort Niagara. That was led by William Shirley himself. But that very quickly fell apart as well. Shirley had never led a military expedition. He was not Edward Braddock. And in the process, he proved himself to be a terribly ineffective, not only inefficient, but almost wholly ineffective military leader as well. He was a politician. The attack on Fort Niagara was almost entirely bogged down by simply, what we could say, by terrible mismanagement in almost every way possible. And with the abandonment of the plan to capture Fort Niagara, the Alexandria Conference was now 0-2 in its great effort to disjoint and perhaps uproot the power of New France in North America. But remember, there were still two more, and that's worth exploring in many ways, because some of the best victories, or at least absent defeats, we'll say, will occur in that time period. One of the targets, and this is critically important, was Fort St. Frederick on the Lake Champlain corridor. Now, when we think of North America at this time, we have to be very clear how colonists viewed it. It was really a world where movement was completely facilitated by waterways, and regions were really defined by them. It's why the Ohio country, as the home of the Ohio River, was given that name. Now, there are a few other very important waterways we have to be aware of. One is the Mohawk River Valley, which stretches from Lake Ontario eastward through the heart of New York State. And the other is the Lake Champlain Corridor. The St. Lawrence River Valley will lead into Lake Champlain. That will be connected to Lake George, which with a short distance can connect to the Hudson River, which goes all the way, of course, to modern New York City. Well, the attention of this next part of the Alexandria Conference's plan will be on that corridor, because there is a fort called Fort St. Frederick, which sits immediately on the shores of Lake Champlain, between what is today New York State and Vermont. Now, Fort St. Frederick was the target for William Johnson. He was present at the Alexandria Conference. But that plan will very quickly change. The British already have a fort built on the corridor in some way, shape, or form. One is known as Fort Edward, which is just off the Hudson River. And the other is called Fort William Henry. This is the place where the very incredible scene, which we'll talk about in future episodes, from Last of the Mohicans takes place, on the southern end of Lake George. The plan, again, is a few dozen miles north at Fort St. Frederick. And the French are very careful as to how to deal with this. Now, one of the things we mention over and over again is that New France is really completely connected. You have to understand it's very much a network facilitated by waterways. But one of the critical points along that network is called Fort Frontenac, which is on the northern shore of Lake Ontario. And Fort Frontenac is so important because it allows for the connection of supplies, reinforcements, and men to trickle down throughout the various other parts of the network. If Fort Frontenac ever fell, the entire network that flows south of it would be eliminated as a result. That's where you could literally make the cut and allow the rest of the network to die on the vine, so to speak. Well, the French focused all their attention on that. But suddenly, with the new threat of William Johnson, decision makers in New France decided to move their forces to the Lake Champlain corridor. It's less strategically important, but that's where the next meaningful British attack would appear. French forces would meet with English forces just south of Fort William Henry in a battle we call the Battle of Lake George. And although the battle was wholly inconclusive, It will lead to a new standoff that will be very important in the future of the war. The British will fully fortify Fort Edward, as well as Fort William Henry on Lake George. And the French will also begin to build a new fortification at this time in 1755 that will become one of the single most important forts not only in the history of the French and Indian War, but the history of all of North America. It will become known as the Gibraltar of North America. They call it Fort Carillon. In the future, it will be known as Fort Ticonderoga. But they'll begin to entrench themselves there, and while it's not a victory for the Alexandria Conference, it is a major turning point in the conflict, because Fort Carillon, that will become Fort Ticonderoga in the future, will be a major point of contention, not only in the French and Indian War, but also the American Revolution as well. So that leaves us effectively with one last quadrant of this plan. Edward Braddock failed, Shirley failed. Johnson, we could say, had some mild success, but not enough to really give us comfort in calling it a victory if we are British. The next part will fall to Fort Beauséjour in Canada, led by Colonel Robert Monckton. And this is an incredibly important event, not only in the history of North America, but the history of Canada and the British Empire as well. The final portion of this attack, and as it turns out, the lone victory of the entire Siege of 1755 in many ways, will be led by a British commander named Robert Monckton, and his goal is to capture a fort on the frontier of the Canadian wilderness known as Fort Beauséjour. Now, why is Fort Beauséjour so important? Well, the real crown jewel in many ways of French Canada was known as the Fortress at Louisbourg, and it's an enormous feature of the landscape that guards the entrance to the St. Lawrence River. And again, that's the heart of New France. Louisbourg is enormous. Louisbourg is the crown jewel of almost the entire French military empire. And Fort Beauséjour, if you could capture it, would be highly important because it would sever that critical supply line that kept the fortress at Louisbourg, which would have to be dealt with later on in the war, open for French prosperity. If Fort Beauséjour falls, French Canada is on its way of falling as well. At least that's the plan. Now, the long and short of it is this. Robert Monckton will capture Fort Beauséjour. The supply line will be cut off. And it's viewed as a major victory in a time where you really don't have many for the British during the early part of what will become known as the French and Indian War. But there's a greater story than that, and it's one that, again, allows us a glimpse of the complexity of the North American world. One of the peoples that lives in the region, and there are thousands of these people, are known as Acadians, and the Acadians are considered to be an ethnic minority who live in the region at the time. Now, British administrators in Canada, at least in that part of it, decide that the Acadians, because they speak French, because they have something of a French heritage, would be aiding the French cause if a war would ever occur. And it was decided by a man named Charles Lawrence, the governor of Nova Scotia, that this ethnic minority should be forcibly removed from the region for fear that they would be a dangerous asset for the French in the event of war. Now, we look at this and we can push it aside, but it's actually very meaningful to us because some will call this perhaps ethnic cleansing. We know that almost 12,000 Acadians are forcibly removed from their ancestral homeland, where they have settled for many decades at that point. Others will call it political deportation. But whatever you want to call it, nearly one-third of the Acadian community of northeastern Canada will die from disease and starvation as they were forcibly deported by the British out of their ancestral home. So where do these native French speakers go? Well, the Acadians will very quickly trickle south, using the Mississippi River in most cases as a place of safety. They'll go into the Illinois country, but many of them will ultimately settle in the next French territory to the south, the next French colony, New Orleans, in Louisiana. The Acadians, when they move there, will very quickly integrate into that Louisianian culture, and they'll develop a new ethnic identity. It's a corruption of their original identity of Acadian, and they become known as Cajun. And that's where we get today's modern Cajun population, in many respects, in Louisiana today. So we see there's many layers to the story and many levels to the story. Was the deportation of the Acadians necessary? It's very difficult to say. But it is a major point of social change brought forward by a war that, again, will eventually spread anywhere British and French colonies exist together, they will fight. And it's one of the minor stories that we often lose sight of when we talk about this enormous global conflict. But make no mistake, it is a very clear benchmark moment in the history of North America and the history of empire. Not only is the capture of Fort Beausejour a major British victory, but the landscape, culturally speaking, of Canada will be changed forever when those Acadians are forcibly removed from their homes. So the Acadians clearly suffer a major social upheaval as a result of this war. And the great thing about this war for historians, and what makes it endlessly fascinating, what makes us discover new things every day, seemingly, is that you see these small social changes affected in all parts of the world, anywhere the war touches. The Seven Years' War, as this event will be known, will take us to all corners of the globe, and we'll see many people seemingly fighting for Britain or France, most of them never having seen the places themselves before, fighting for reasons outwardly that appear for that war, but often for reasons of their own, and we'll talk about as many of them as possible throughout the course of this series. This is only part one of our study of the French and Indian War, but we will talk about the larger effects of the Seven Years' War otherwise, because it is this war that, as many historians believe, really form the collective identity that will make something like the Revolutionary War, only in another 20 years, possible in the American states. I look forward to sharing this information with you. Thank you for listening. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.